Hey, Randy, how's it going?
Good, Jim. That's good to hear from you.
So I heard you wanted to talk about anti-gravity or something like that.
That's right. This week we're going to talk about probably the most exciting thing in horizon physics, and it's the thing that kept me interested in physics from a young age, is the prospect of a gravitational field technology, a synthesized, man-made artificial gravitational field.
And you're looking at this from a particular perspective. You're looking at this from Bob Forward's ideas, as I understand.
That's right. It took a while for me to find this, but it turns out that back in 1961, 1962, an absolutely brilliant physicist who was also a fiction writer named Robert L. Forward had published a couple of papers. And frankly, I found all of his papers to be riveting. He wrote a number of technical memorandums for major defense contractors. One of the papers we're going to look at tonight was a technical paper written for the Hughes Research Corporation, which is one of the top, you know, black projects, top secret military science kind of facilities in the country. Similar probably to Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works. So he was writing papers for these people about cutting-edge theoretical physics concepts, maybe as a cornerstone for them to start new research. We really have no idea what's going on inside these facilities, but it wouldn't surprise me if they haven't played around and extended this work substantially in the last 50 years.
All right, so we've got two papers here. The main one we're going to look at is Guidelines to Anti-Gravity, and that was published in the American Journal of Physics. The American Journal of Physics is an educational journal.
Okay.
So the main use of the American Journal of Physics, I think, is to sort of propagate examples for students. So for...
That's where it got published, but I believe that it was originally written for Hughes Research Laboratories. You should see that at the top of the paper. I downloaded them off the internet. And you'll see at the top under it says Guidelines to Anti-Gravity, Robert L. Forward, Hughes Research Laboratories, Malibu, California, received on the 12th of September, 62. And then you can see that it was reprinted from the American Journal of Physics from 1963. So I believe it was initially written for them and then published.
When you're reading these things,
yeah,
where it says Hughes Research Laboratory, Malibu, California, that's just his address.
Oh, so that's where he was employed at the time. When he wrote this paper. Okay.
Yeah. So this wasn't a top secret paper that he snuck out to a bunch of undergraduates.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that it was a top secret paper smuggled out, but it was, I mean, Hughes Research Laboratories and Hughes Aircraft, I believe it is today, they do a lot of that really cutting edge black projects kind of research in science. I met a scientist who, a physicist, while I was studying at USC, who said that, that he couldn't tell me what he was working on, but anything that I could imagine, they had already done. And I was like, well, you know, I can imagine a lot. And he's like, I know.
Okay. So I mean, yeah, I mean, Bob Forward was working on a lot of things like that. He also wrote this General Relativity for the Experimentalist, which was in the Proceedings of the IRE. Do you know what IRE stands for?
Yeah, Institute of Radio Engineers.
It's a defunct journal. It was, now it's part of the IEEE, which is a large electrical engineering. It is the electrical engineering society. So, you know, this is a reasonably good thing. So when I looked this up, and I'm on IEEE Explore, it says this stopped being published in 1962. Go to the Proceedings of the IEEE.
Well, this is why I love Robert Forward so much, is that he was writing about really on the fringe concepts. Like, here he is talking about, well, how do you do experiments on general relativity in a laboratory environment? How do you create gravitational effects that you can measure? And he was a very credible mainstream scientific thinker. I mean, here his papers were published, like you say, in reputable places, and it's all based on very firm science.
I'd like to get into the deep stuff in a later time, but I mean, there are a lot of interesting things in this paper about, you know, different systems that he's looking at in this approximation that he has. I think it's worthwhile to just talk about that approximation before we talk about those systems, just say what the issues are, right?
Yeah, I want to do that too, but first I want to mention that what we're talking about has very recently come to the fore in terms of a viable experimental proposal. There's a paper called How Current Loops and Solenoids Curve Space-Time in Physics Review D by an author named Fuzfa. This was a 2015 paper. And in that paper, he describes a fairly challenging but attainable experimental setup involving two superconducting solenoids to be powered under constant current. I believe it's something like 10,000 amps of electrical current that could distort space-time enough to shift the phase of light propagating through that space-time and be detected. So here we've got a proposal that we could do. It looks like it's about maybe on the scale of Sandia's Z machine experiment, where you've got like these 30-foot diameter superconducting magnets, and you've got a laser beam bouncing between along the axis that it joins them. And it shifts the phase of the light enough that you could detect it with an interferometer, similar to that in the LIGO experiment, the LIGO gravitational wave detectors.
So I thought you were just talking about measuring the change of the phase of light.
That's right. That's exactly right. You'd pass a beam between the solenoids and then pass another beam that wouldn't go through the solenoid so that you could detect the change in the geometry of space-time, or the distance, I guess, between them.
Yeah, so that would be a standard interferometer setup. There's no reason to talk about something on the scale of LIGO, right?
Well, it wouldn't need to be as big, but it would use the exact same principle and the same high-precision tuning that they've employed to get their detection sensitivity down to like 10 to the minus 11th radians per second of shift. So using that level of sensitivity on a much smaller scale, you don't need laser beams that are like a kilometer long or anything. I think you just need them a few meters in the case of this experiment, that you could detect the shift of the phase in the interference pattern.
Okay, so we'll talk about that at some point after I've actually looked at that. And
well, I just wanted to mention it because we're talking about these 1961 and 1962 papers, and at that time, this kind of experiment was considered to be beyond the reach of our current technology, and Robert Forward, in a few cases, mentions things that we hadn't proven yet, like he was talking about the gravitomagnetic field. He calls it the rotational field because I believe at that time the term gravitomagnetic hadn't been invented yet. And we've already proven the gravitomagnetic field around the Earth. I believe he proposes a satellite experiment to test it, but he felt that it was beyond our ability to detect. Well, 40 years, 50 years later, we did that experiment, and after NASA made some breakthrough advances in gyroscope technology, and we were able to verify that that the gravitomagnetic coupling induces the type of shift in the gyroscopes to within 10% of the prediction of general relativity.
Okay, we'll put that on the list too.
Okay.
So basically what you want to point out here is that even though these are old papers, they still have something to offer.
Oh, they still have a lot to offer, but it's fascinating that even since they were published, we've already accumulated additional experimental evidence that really shores up the foundation of their basic assumptions and tenets, which is that, you know, if you put our thinking caps on, we can move ahead with experimentation on artificial gravitational fields in the lab.
All right, so let's actually talk about these papers. We wanted to talk about sort of the assumptions that go into this, because Forward's just looking at things in an approximation. So he wants to look at these things in an approximation that would be viable for, you know, human experimentation.
Yeah, in order to make the equations, to give us equations which an engineer would be comfortable using to predict the magnitude of effects to within the first order approximation, he went through a process in general relativity for the experimentalist where if you go to the weak field limit, and you use small masses using it at non-relativistic velocities, et cetera, you can arrive at some analytical equations which are pretty easy to work with that are actually in form identical to Maxwell's equations.
Okay, yeah, and And I think it's important. I think this is one of these things where, if you're talking about something like this, I think it's important to keep in mind everything that's in the approximation. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're talking about sort of low mass density, mm-hmm. sort of normal mass density.
Right.
We're talking about much slower than the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
The kinetic and potential energies that we're using to describe the system should be much less than the rest mass of any of the objects that we care about.
Mm-hmm.
The fields are always weak enough so that superposition is valid. And basically what that means is that the bending of space is such that you can always use a sort of local linear approximation and have a linear force to work with.
Okay.
And the distance between two objects aren't really, really, really large, right? So you're dealing with sizes of things that you could reasonably do, not just in the laboratory, but possibly Earth, in something the size of the Earth. But you don't really care about, this approximation isn't going to work very well for anything where, you're looking at the interaction between galaxies or something like that.
Right. Yeah, there's no delay in the propagation that you can measure.
Yeah, the way he's done this is, you don't worry about that delay. That's what we do in electromagnetism all the time for undergraduates, and for most of your graduate stuff as well, because it doesn't really matter for most effects. So he had basically two parts to this paper, Guidelines for Anti-Gravity. And some of these things are repeated in the other paper, and a lot of the things that I'd like to bring in from the other paper would be things that were would fit in the first part of this, when he talks about non-Newtonian gravitational forces. But basically he's looking at the effects, the gravitational effects that don't look just like Newton's law of universal gravitation. And the second part are devices and what you need to have for those devices that actually might have some interesting gravitomagnetic effect, basically.
Yeah, what was great about general relativity for the experimentalist is that he went through and showed you the derivations and the full equations and even gave you some numerical examples of the linearized equations that he was employing, and to show you the magnitude of results of different types of scenarios in the, that would be reasonably attainable in a lab. But in Guidelines to Anti-Gravity, he's focusing more on the types of effects that that can be observed where you're looking at the inductive qualities of gravitomagnetism, where you've got moving masses interacting with both stationary and other moving test bodies. And then he gets into the experimental concepts, and that's where it really gets exciting, because he talks about, at the very end, he brings in a generator, what a generator might look like, of a dipole gravitational field.
Yeah. Basically, it starts out and he gives you these different things to look at.
Right. Like, first he shows you the rotating ring, right?
Yeah. So I think he's just sort of building this up, because he's adding in each one of these another effect. So, yeah, first he just has this rotating ring. So that's a steady state effect. And it's a lot like having just a current loop, which is what we do in electromagnetism to generate a dipole field,
mm-hmm.
right?
But I think what he's showing you is there's a counterintuitive effect that we don't conventionally think of when we think of gravity. And in this case, what he's talking about is that if you have a test body that's inside a spinning ring of mass, and the spinning ring acts like a mass current, which is the analogy of an electrical current, that the test body won't fall towards the center of gravity like you might expect, but it'll actually be repelled from the center of gravity and it'll move towards the ring. And that's a counterintuitive thought, because we're used to thinking of things falling towards the center of gravity.
Okay, so you're certain that that's what he means? Because one of the issues that I had with reading this, and it's still here,
mm-hmm.
Is that I'm not completely sure. I guess that is right.
It says here, yeah, forces the test body away from the axis in imitation of the centrifugal force.
The force that he gave was an approximation,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't completely sure what that approximation was. It should not be surprising that the effect is more or less the opposite of what you get with a current loop, because the sign is opposite for gravitation. And so it's kind of a little odd what it does, but yeah, you're right. It's pushing away in the plane.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not directly on that axis, what it's going to do is it's going to get pulled up towards that rotating ring.
Yeah, in the plane of rotation, it'll get attracted to that, but it'll get sort of repelled from the center.
Yeah, it's attracted to the ring around it, and it gets pushed towards the center in the axial direction, and in the directions perpendicular to that, it gets pushed towards that ring,
mm-hmm.
at least according to this approximation, and assuming that this approximation is only good on the inside.
Yeah, I don't know what happens on the outside. We'd have to look at that in terms of some numbers.
Well, yeah, we'd actually work it out. And he doesn't have much of a guide here. He just sort of gives three components of a force. He gives it as acceleration, but it's basically just the force on the object.
Well, that's not entirely true because it doesn't matter what the mass of the test body is. So it wouldn't really be force as much as acceleration, right?
Well, what he's produced is really the gravitational field. The gravitational field is an acceleration.
That's right.
So the electric field is not, but because the charge and the inertia are the same, because of the equivalence between gravitational charge and inertial mass, just turns it directly into a acceleration. And so that's why it gives these as accelerations. But obviously you can just look at it as a force because, again, they're the same thing.
Okay.
Because one of the interesting things is that he calls these non-Newtonian forces. But he doesn't say why they're non-Newtonian. I think, for the most part, he's just saying these are pseudo-forces. These are like centrifugal force, because it's a false force. It's just there because you've linearized the coordinate system in some way. So centrifugal force, you're just pretending like your rotating thing is not rotating. And then you have to have a fake force that's pushing everything out from the center.
Right.
In this case, obviously, you're taking, the full general relativity, which says everything's twisty and funny looking, and then you're flattening it out and saying, well, what happens if I pretend it's not twisty and funny looking? And you say, well, you have this additional sort of, you have to have this additional force, which does these strange things. That's how I think he means it, right? When first he said non-Newtonian forces, what I thought he meant was they did not follow one of the three Newton's laws. But instead, all it is it a way of accounting for nonlinear effects in a linear environment.
Okay. Yeah, we're looking at Maxwell's style behaviors with induction and everything instead of the basic laws of motion that Newton came up with.
Well, Maxwell's equations are perfectly fine for all of these things as far as Newton's laws are concerned. So I don't see that there's an issue there.
Newton doesn't have anything like induction, right? There's no such thing as he didn't know anything about the magnetic field or anything like that, right?
No, he didn't know anything about the magnetic field, but that doesn't mean that Newton's laws don't apply. Yeah, that's another issue, but Newton's laws still apply in electrostatics and magnetostatics.
So this is why you're thinking that when he said non-Newtonian, he might be referring to the equivalence principle and how there wasn't a difference between charge and inertial mass?
No, I don't think that at all.
Okay.
What I think is that when he says non-Newtonian forces, all he means is that we're pretending like space-time is flat. And even in our approximation, we have these small deviations from a flat space-time. And we're just going to pretend that those small deviations are forces rather than geodesy.
Okay. That makes sense. Because, yeah, although I do struggle with this at this point, because now after checking out G4V... I'm so strongly favoring that as an assumption that I'm not even thinking in terms of curved space-time anymore. I'm just looking at that as an interpretation of the forces and effects.
Well, I guess that could be another way of looking at things. Obviously, if you can look at a curved space-time as if it was forces, then you could look at forces as if they're a curved space-time. Okay, but what Forward does in this paper is then he goes on and he adds stuff, right? So first he has the rotating ring. Then he decides, okay, what I want to do is I want to have a moving test particle on the inside of a hollow rotating sphere. I think that's important because the hollow sphere, there's no force on that object on the inside.
Because the static gravitational component is zero everywhere inside a hollow sphere. And so any forces that you see are the purely vector potential generated forces, right?
Well, yeah. Anything that you see on the inside is purely due to the rotation. And what he ends up with is basically two forces on that mass, right, that he adds together. One is basically a stationary force right, which is almost identical within a factor to the rotating ring. So the rotating ring has a nasty factor of lots of little constants that aren't really important, but it's proportional to the square of the rotation rate, and it has a factor of 1/2 on it. The stationary force for the rotating sphere has that same omega squared factor, and it has a factor of 4/15 instead of 1/2. For whatever reason, I'm not sure why it has a factor of 4/15.
I think it might be 4/5, and I think that has something to do with...
It's 4/15 because I've separated out these two things. The way Forward has it written, he's got both effects combined in each direction. So what I did was, because I recognized the similarities, is I just separated out the stationary part, which is the part that looks like the result from the rotating ring.
Oh, I see.
And the dynamic part.
And you combined the denominators.
And so for whatever this 1/2 factor is for the rotating ring, that's a 4/15 factor. It's a lot like, it's not exactly like, but it's a lot like, say, a moment of inertia. It might be a lot closer than I think it is, but it's not exactly what you'd get with a moment of inertia as far as I know, but it's similar enough that it's interesting. Especially that you get these differences that are like a moment of inertia.
So inside this rotating sphere, I didn't quite see where these different forces break down. There's two different equations, one for the XY plane, and I guess that's the equatorial rotation. Then there's a Z component.
Okay, so yeah. Now remember what's happening here is the sphere is rotating around the Z axis, okay? Just like the ring was rotating around the Z axis in the previous example. So if you look at each one of these terms, right, you have this 4/5 omega squared x, right? And you have this 4/5 omega squared y. And you have something very, very similar. If you go down to the z, you have this 8/15 omega squared z. All of these things are the same force, basically. They have the same position dependence as that force for the rotating ring, which is... The force for the rotating ring is proportional to the distance in the XY plane from that axis minus twice the distance in the Z direction, so from the center of mass of the object. That same dependence is in both of these examples. And that's the stationary bit. That says my particle is not moving. The additional part that he actually puts in here is that 8 omega Vy, 8 omega Vx. And that's actually a cross product, basically, of omega and V. So of the rotation and the rotation of the body, which is around the k-axis. So the rotation of the body, which is around the z-axis, and the velocity in whatever direction it's going. The velocity, so the rotation of the sphere and the velocity of the test particle.
Okay, so what would happen if you had a test particle just placed above the plane of rotation in this spinning scenario? Is it going to fall towards the plane of rotation and towards the shell at the equator?
So if you just place it in here and it's not moving in that spherical shell, it'll have almost the exact dependence as the test body in the rotating ring. The only difference will be it will feel a smaller force than with the rotating ring, given that the rotating ring and the rotating shell have the same mass and the same radius and are moving at the same speed and stuff like that.
Okay. And then he moves on to the effect of accelerated masses on stationary bodies.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. Now, is this frame dragging?
Yes.
So in that case, he breaks it down into three cases, right? And these cases are the normal gravitational force. That first term is the normal gravitational force. So the force on a test body from a big moving thing going by it is the gravitational force that it would normally feel, then basically the acceleration of that giant moving body times the scalar potential and a constant factor. So the scalar potential between these two, the scalar potential Basically, it's the potential energy of situation times the acceleration of the big thing divided by the square of the speed of light. So based on how these two things are interacting with each other, the interaction strength is basically the scalar potential.
That's the regular gravitational force that we all know and love.
And then it gets pulled also with the acceleration that this other body has.
Tangentially, that's the tangential component, right?
It does not say, according to this, that's not the tangential component. Now, there's another component. That third component, I think, is. So it has a projection of the acceleration on the direction between the big object and the small object. I think that's what you just meant.
It's sort of a combination of both the scalar and the vector components, right?
Okay, so let's see. I've got four things that I go here. I have a constant. I have the scalar potential again, the gravitational potential energy. I've got the projection of the acceleration in the direction of the vector connecting the center of mass of the two objects. And then I have the velocity of the big object. And so that, I think, is what you were talking about in that previous one, the tangential component. That's one way to talk about the tangential component. Normally, I talk about the tangential component as a component in the direction of the velocity.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, is that it's going to be parallel to the surface velocity at the equator, on the equatorial plane, right?
V is the velocity of the large body, what direction it's moving, right? So...
Oh, I see. He doesn't have the test mass in the equatorial plane. He's got it off at some funny angle.
Yeah, it's doing whatever it wants to do.
So that's why he shows you the vector math to show you the final trajectory.
Yeah. So I mean, that's sort of useful because he's got three different forces, and this one's going this way, this one's going that way, and so forth and so on. One's completely radial, right, which is going to be our normal one. The one that's kind of in the direction of the velocity is the last one that I was just talking about, and there's one in terms of the acceleration of the large object. So basically you have three forces on the small object that are based on the motion of the large object, the motion and the position of the large object.
Okay, so what's the final result in that case? It looks like the resultant vector is directly towards the center of gravity, so how would you even notice that?
I don't think that's true. I think that he doesn't have anything for the resultant. So that R is the distance from the center of mass of the small object to the center of mass of the big object. That is not the resultant.
Oh, I see.
And he has a very, in that particular figure, figure 3 in this guidelines to anti-gravity that I'll link to in the show notes. In that figure, he has a very special configuration to make it as clear as possible what's going on with each one of these terms that he's labeled F1, F2, and F3, which are those three components that I talked about earlier.
I see.
The regular force, the force from the acceleration, and the force from the velocity. These are the forces in those directions. Anyways, this is as simple as he can get it, but he hasn't put an actual resultant direction in there. I'm not sure if he really can... considering you don't know what V and A are comparatively, right? You'd have to actually plug in some numbers, and that, in this particular case, that direction can probably be anywhere from completely perpendicular to the direction of motion of the large body to directly parallel to it. It probably can be anywhere in that range, depending on the relative values of R, A, and V.
Since we know what gravitomagnetism does, then we know that if a test body is near a rotating massive body like the Earth, that to some or even more dramatically to like a rotating neutron star, instead of falling straight in, it would actually fall in kind of a spiral trajectory.
Yeah, actually that's a little more like the previous example.
What, the sphere?
Yeah, so this one, the effect of the accelerated masses on the stationary bodies, that has a long way to go to start talking about what happens with a rotating thing. But the dynamical effect in the rotating hollow sphere is just that. The dynamical effect is basically a rotation effect. So the interaction with the stationary particle is just like with the ring, where it's trying to go towards the center of mass in the Z direction, but towards the edge in the X and Y directions. whereas the effect of the rotation is to make the particle spin around. And I didn't look at these signs, so I don't know if these signs are going the same direction as the rotation or not. I think it's in the same direction as the rotation.
Yeah, it says it gets dragged along with it, so it's got to be the same direction.
So that's where that effect actually shows up. So this is not the effect that we think it is. This is just a big object that's accelerating in some direction. It's going to pull this other object along with it.
Oh, no wonder I'm getting all mixed up. I thought that the acceleration that he was talking about was the rotational, was the acceleration at the surface. And I thought it was a rotating body and not an actual, this is a linearly moving solid body. And yeah, in that case, when you have an object that's, you know, accelerating in a given direction, then any test body nearby, it will sort of get pulled along in that direction with it.
Yeah.
And this is showing exactly how it gets attracted towards the center and in and how much is along the direction of its movement and how much is towards the flight path.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. Yeah, now I would like to get this moving along because, you know, we have time constraints. And you were really interested in talking about these devices.
Yeah, because when he did go through in both of these papers a couple examples. One where there's a fluid moving through a couple of pipes, and you get a pinch effect, which is analogous to Ampere's law, where you get an attraction or repulsion from currents moving in parallel wires. There was another example that he gave. Let's see. I can't remember what it was. He did some.
Okay. The other thing that, so the two things that he did in this paper was the flow through the pipes, right? Yeah. And the other one were rotating gyroscopes. And the rotating gyroscopes act like magnetic moments.
Yeah. And you know what was fascinating about that is that if you have two rotating gyroscopes, you said that that the gravimagnetic effect could cause them to repel each other.
Yes.
So he's saying that the gravimagnetic effect can be stronger than the scalar potential between them. And that's exciting.
Well, I'm not sure if he's saying that, but is he saying that the net effect of the rotation is in the opposite direction?
No, he said that you could actually get them to repel.
Yeah, he says repel each other if oriented properly. I'm still not completely sure if, since he doesn't have an actual number here, I'm not sure if he's saying that the object will actually go the opposite direction.
I'd love to do that, to do a calculation on that, because it's really critical for a lot of things.
But I mean, it is interesting. I mean, that is one way to model a magnetic moment. It's one way to model a magnetic moment like the spin of an electron in an object, and if that's possible, I mean, that would be interesting. I don't know. In one of these cases, in one of these papers, he talked about. He didn't talk about the speeds. He talked about the density, right, of things. How and stresses. So the issue, one of the issues here was that to really see a lot of these effects, you need things to be going really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And material stress limits are somewhere around the speed of sound. So that means that if you're spinning something, right, and you have this centrifugal force, right, mm-hmm. if you have this outward pressing force on the ring or whatever for your gyroscope, and it goes past the speed of sound, then it's going to break apart. You need something to keep them together. And he said that, you know, if you've got really, really massive things, right, mm-hmm. then the massive things can provide that attraction to keep things together.
Gravitationally,
but something in the laboratory, if you wanted to look at something like this in the laboratory, just to keep something together while it spins fast enough that you might actually be able to see it, you'll have to use magnets or an electric field.
Right, and that's a good idea. I suppose that something like that would have to come into play in the scenario where he's describing this gravitational dipole generator that looks like a choke for in electronics, where you have a toroidal core with a winding of electrical current around it, except in this case the winding is replaced by pipes that have a flowing fluid through them, so you have a mass current flowing in this spiral around a donut shaped ring, and in this case all of the flow is happening in the same direction through the center and in the same direction on the outside edges, and this if you accelerate that flow, then you create a gravitational dipole.
Yeah, so he needs this constantly linearly accelerating flow rate, which is a little, yeah, I mean, you know, you've got a limit to that. He needs this, the way he's set this up is that he has a linearly increasing flow rate. But on top of that, you have some issues where you have all sorts of different parameters, and they're all going to change a little bit when you're doing this. So it's not quite as easy as just it's not quite as easy as if you were doing this electronically and trying to create an electric field. The way that this is set up is basically in analogy to creating an electric dipole, using a winding over a torus.
Well, if we look at it just in pure theoretical terms, wouldn't an ordinary toroidal conductor have a non-zero but immeasurable gravitational dipole when it's charging up, because the electrons are moving in that spiral around the core, and they have mass, and they'd be accelerating? Like if we used a superconducting wire, Carver-Mead talked about, and you put a potential on it, the current continually increases, right?
Yeah.
So we would never be able to measure it, but an ordinary toroidal inductor may already be a very, very weak dipole gravitational field generator.
Well, I mean, it would have to be. I was thinking about that a little bit here, because even though we normally think of, a lot of times when we're talking about electromagnetism, we're just talking about the flow of charge. When you have that charge flow, when you have a charge flow, you have a mass flow as well.
Right.
And so you'd have to have the same sort of effects occurring as well. Although, you know, the charge that's actually increasing is, the charge is moving very slowly on average. And so is the actual amount of matter, the actual mass is very small as well. But the same ideas would apply. So if you could create this electric dipole, and you can, then you should be creating this gravitational dipole at the same time, although it's in the opposite direction. But other than that, there's no issue.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I would love to see an experiment like this done. He talks about some of the limitations that we'd have to overcome in order to make observable effects in the laboratory. And have you got any ideas on those? He spelled out the need for much, much higher density materials. He brought up degenerate matter. I'm not sure what degenerate matter is. And then he also talked about superpositions of like two tetraneutrons and other cold boson condensates, so that you could get particles superimposed upon each other and overcome these density limitations.
Yeah, I mean, he said you need something like that. I'm not really sure how many places you have anything like that on Earth. Right. And I think that was part of his issue. I don't really know what the densities they have gotten with the condensates. He was very, very far away from seeing any condensates at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think they're anywhere near this. So, you know, in standard SI units, he's talking about 10 to the 11th to 10 to the 18th kilograms per cubic meter. And that is really, really dense. So the density of lead is 11,300. So 1 times 10 to the 4th kilograms per cubic meter. So it's a long way from wherever we'd want to be.
What is degenerate matter? Is that I guess it would be like neutron stars, where there are no longer distinguishable protons and neutrons, but there's just kind of like a quark gluon plasma. Is that what he's talking about?
I think in general it's, you know, this weird mixture of particles and that you get in white dwarfs, and it's not something that you really have on Earth, right? So I'm not sure if people know how to make it. I don't think so.
Well, we've created a quark gluon plasmas by colliding like heavy nuclei, like gold nuclei, together. But of course, that's only a fraction of a moment that we create that, extremely high pressures and temperatures. But I think we have created it at that micro instantaneous scale. I think they studied quark gluon jets and that kind of thing coming out of this plasma that's not really nuclear material anymore.
But all those things are things that, you know, we can't control. I can't really find anything that tells me about, you know, what the largest density that you can have with a real thing is. I can find, you know, what the largest element is, but I can't find, you know, sort of things that we can barely create, what those are. I didn't do that research. It looks like 10 to the 4th is where we are, and we need 10 to the 11th, according to him. Although, you know, some of these things, tetraneutrons, maybe you can make them, I don't know. But really what he wants to do is he wants to get some sort of matter that has some sort of nonlinear property, right?
Now you're talking about the idea he was talking about, like the gravitational analog of an electrical transformer, and he was saying that in order to amplify these fields, that we'd need a material that had a very high and nonlinear, like gravitomagnetic permeability.
Yeah. So basically, he needs something like a ferromagnetic material. He needs some. He needs ferrogravitation, right? Possibly that means he'd need something like paragravitation before that. He'd need something that would have this polarized magnetic field already sort of coming from it. That's basically what a ferromagnet is. That's what this whole nonlinear density is in a ferromagnet, right? Or that's what the nonlinear permeability in a ferromagnet is it's basically...
The existing magnetic field in the atoms? The arrangement of atoms?
Yeah, it's basically that... The magnetic field is already there because each one of these atoms has its own spin, angular momentum, and that's a magnetic moment that creates a little field, and those fields have to align themselves. So you need two things, really, to make something like a ferromagnet. One, you need a paragravitation, right, of all things, which would be a sort of each atom would have to have its own sort of gravitational dipole moment. On top of that, you'd want paragravitational, I can't believe I'm saying that. You'd want these paragravitational atoms to actually want to align themselves the way a ferromagnet does with some sort of exchange interaction. So you need two things to make that actually work. And I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Well, he mentioned in this paper that the magnetic moment and the inertial moment are combined in atoms, and that provides a direct coupling between time-varying electromagnetic fields and time-varying gravitomagnetic fields. So, and I was thinking about how in MRIs, when they set up the high magnetic field, they actually align the magnetic moments of the atoms, of the hydrogen atoms, and then they use a radiation field, an EM field, it works at the same frequency as the precession of that axis along the magnetic field in order to spin them out along the equator. So we can already control, to some extent, the rotational axis of the nuclei. So maybe we could do that with other materials. You know, I was thinking about how uranium and maybe the super heavy elements that we haven't been able to find yet on the island of stability have an asymmetrical core. They're sort of oblate spheroids, and some people think that the super heavy elements will have like a dumbbell shaped nucleus. And so if you get those babies rotating, then you should be able to generate not just a gravitomagnetic field, but gravitational waves.
Well, I guess that would be interesting, depending on it. But, I mean, how long would they actually last?
Well, I know that you with an MRI machine, they can align the axis of rotation indefinitely as long as they keep the field on. And then they spin them up to do an equatorial rotation with radio waves, but in that before they turn it off and then detect the energy when they restore back to their axial orientation. So we can already do some of this kind of thing, is, you know, indefinitely using a magnetic field. I think that this was a direction that a NASA scientist named Ning Li was going in. She was doing something different, though. She was taking a superconducting material and spinning it, and I believe that she was using the spin of this disk to align the spin of the atoms in the material. I'm not sure how that works. It's something that has to do with gyromagnetic or gyroscopic forces, but then she disappeared. There was a little bit of talk about her work in that direction, and then people think that she got to work on a military project because nobody's heard anything since.
But so scary. It's so scary. Science is so scary.
Well, I guess when you get into the really good stuff, the military wants to classify it and use it to make weapons or something.
Possibly. Okay. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about with these guys? I know you've got something to go to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I got to go say goodbye to somebody. So I'll say goodbye to you first, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for this, Randy. We'll get together another time to talk about GR for the Experimentalist in more detail, possibly talk about it with respect to that G4V. And we had two other things we wanted to get to. What was that first one you wanted to talk about?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
The recent paper from 2015?
Oh, the one that I mentioned in the beginning? That was the experimental setup. It's probably more of a footnote than a podcast. It was called How Current Loops and Solenoids Curve Spacetime. And that's the experiment where he set up two superconducting magnets in an anti-Helmholtz configuration where they're in opposition, and then bounces a laser beam between the two of them because... the distance should be, in general relativity terms, should be, I believe, shortened. And that would put the photons out of phase every time as they spent more time in there. The problem that I see with that experiment is that you would need the photons to bounce back and forth along the axis where these two magnets are in opposition for something like 6 months. Well, how do you get a laser beam to bounce back off of two mirrors for 6 months without dissipating?
That's a good question.
I mean, is there really a 100% efficient mirror?
No, probably.
Unlikely.
Let's see. The other thing that we wanted to talk about, or that I wanted to talk about, was you said that NASA had been doing something with the precision gyroscopes. And so we can talk about that as well.
Oh, for the Gravity Probe B.
Yeah, and we can talk about those things as well, all in future episodes.
Sounds great. Stay tuned.
All right. Talk to you later, Randy.
Bye, Jim.
Okay, bye now.
Well, maybe we should do a thing where we're like, three, two, one, now on. And then at least then you'll know you're synchronized or something, right?
You know, we could try this. Just react naturally and then go with the program, all right?
All right, I'm reacting as naturally as I can.
Hey, Randy, how's it going?
Good, Jim. That's good to hear from you.